The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And, you know, what was really delightful last year when I played this other kid, the Ian, the punk cellist, he goes by. It was his first fest, and so he played in the Jawbreaker cello quartet for our set, and he also did his own solo set of punk cello karaoke stuff. And people ate it up. Like, they absolutely loved it. And so now he's like really, he's making videos, and he's like doing punk karaoke shows and like wedding, you know, elder emo weddings and stuff like that, where people walk down to like favorite, walk down the aisle of their favorite emo songs or what have you.
So amazing.
Hello and welcome to the Adulting Well podcast. I am your co-host, Pepper. I am joined, as always, by the wonderful Kevin McCracken. Kevin, how are you doing today?
Excellent. I am doing excellent. I'm glad it's the end of the day for us. Gordon, thank you for doing this late your time. So our guest is somebody I've gotten to know over the last, year and a half or so via email for a variety of reasons.
It's 5 years in pandemic time.
Right? Gordon Withers, who is a accomplished cellist, but also a great guy and has so many more facets to his life than just music, which is not a small portion of anyone's life, but is amazing. And part of the reason I wanted to have you on the show. So welcome and thank you.
You're welcome. I'm excited.
It's good.
Thanks for having
totally,
me.
Totally. So, Joshua, what do you have behind your head back there?
I've got this.
Yes. No, above. What's that record?
Oh, I've got the record. Yeah. I've got the record. I've got the
look at that.
The Jawbreaker on cello.
I thought I saw that.
I mean, I don't want to jump right into that, but it is a beautiful thing, Gordon. You made this record. It's a Jawbreaker songs on cello. I was playing Bivouac for my wife this morning, and it's so interesting what a song that is outside of its trappings. You know what I mean? Like, outside of all of its as a Muzak performance, it's sweeping and emotional and it's just interesting. I guess what I'm trying to say is there are songs that seem to hold up when they go from genre to genre to genre. Or is it that you're so good, Gordon, that you could take any song and make it into a timeless classic?
That's definitely it. No, no, it's a great song, and it's the one that came out the best, I think, out of the bunch that I did for that record. Yeah. But it's because it's such an amazing song, and it's such a weird song too.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
Like, especially for a punk band.
Sure.
Like 80 minutes long, and
yeah,
it has like 500 parts, but the parts change so much and they're so different from, you know, in between each other. It was definitely the hardest one to transcribe for cello quartet for the live performances we've done.
Cool.
And it was the most confusing, you know, when I was trying to teach other cellists like what the parts were and like how to play them, because it would switch between double time and half time and do all these
things,
like change keys. And it's really a fascinating composition.
Do you condense things? Is it a condensed version?
Well, I cut out like the last 70 minutes of the, you know, the jam part at the end. But, you know, we do a little bit of it and then we kind of fade out.
When did you start playing music?
When did I start? I started cello in fourth grade.
So why?
Like 9 years old. Because it was like, you know, I had it. I was blessed. Public school.
Yeah.
Public education. Yeah. You know, music program, actual music program with like donated instruments and, you wow. know, that sort of thing. So like we had an instrument, you know, if you signed up for it, you would get an instrument.
That's, sure. That's
the first year or so.
Yeah.
I had the clarinet. Yeah,
I was a product of the public education system. So go socialism.
And did you just take to it and go, oh, music, here it is. This is what I'm doing now.
Yeah, or... I mean, I'd had piano lessons as a younger kid.
Oh, okay.
Kindergarten. And then I listened to music a lot. I think the catalyst was really the fact that like I would come downstairs by myself on Saturday mornings when, you know, early days of MTV,
mm-hmm.
and just put MTV on and like play for a couple sure. hours. So like 4 or 5 years old, you know,
sure.
listening to all the early MTV videos and songs and things. And that kind of like, I think set me up for a weird music career or quasi career after that.
It was formative. Peter Gabriel and who else was on? Who was on the first?
I mean, Madonna, Michael Jackson. Yeah, all, sure. All that. But a lot of like weird UK bands, because those were the only bands that had made music videos up to that point.
Totally true.
They had been making them, I think, prior to MTV,
sure,
to some extent. And so when MTV launched, there was this whole sort of cache of those UK new wave bands videos,
right.
So that I really gravitated towards that, and that kind of,
well,
that must have shaped
a lot of them, like converted their live performances on like Top of the Pops to mm-hmm. video, you know, where they were like, hey, here's our cut from Top of the Pops or whatever. And a lot of them are like those really bad lip syncing things where they're just like dancing in the white dude, you know, new wave coming from England dance, like the Depeche Modes and the, you know, the Cure and, like, it's just like, so, I mean, some of them were really good though, too. I think the Cure and Echo and the Bunnymen made some pretty like storytelling style videos yep. back in the day. But, so you start playing cello, like, how did you get into like more independent music and kind of the stuff that brought you to, you know, some of the things you've recorded? You know, there's obviously other bands you've been in, which we'd love to talk about. So.
I mean, I was at that, you know, other than like the formative MTV stuff, I was, you know, that, so my early love of rock music and new wave music, it was really, you know, I was at the exact age where grunge and Nirvana broke, like when I was 13, 14, like that exact magical age where your,
sure.
your taste is like at its, you know, is being influenced most
right.
based on, you know, where you are in life. So, that's what did it. It was all like that independent alternative rock, grunge, breaking, you know, punk as well.
Yeah, yeah, Green Day happened like signs like right around then at the same time and were huge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
Central Pennsylvania, so kind of middle of nowhere. That was actually, you know, I know it was sort of pre-internet, so it was, although it was pretty torturous in many regards, like it was good. In that the few of us who did find each other through music, like had a really strong connection.
Yeah. I mean,
like, I was just about to ask that because here you are, this grunge listening to cello playing classically trained on piano, fella walking around school. And did you have a group of like musician weirdos that you hung out with?
Yeah. You know, it was such a sort of rural area that, we would have to find each, it would be like three of us at each school. And then like, eventually like we'd find each other.
Nice.
we were really blessed in that, that music scene in Central Pennsylvania, the sort of punk scene was very influenced by the DC scene.
Yeah.
But not just in terms of the style of music, but in terms of like the ethos and philosophies and the like very inclusive, very, you know, kind of welcoming, very progressive, very DIY. And so we would have a few of them actually were on, I don't know if it's the board of directors or what, but we had a local community center. Yeah. And there were, you know, a few of the folks in the scene were involved in that. Like they're 5 years, they're the Gen X kind of generation, like 5 or 10 years older than us. But they helped put on shows and get bands from other, you know, who were touring through to come through this middle of nowhere central Pennsylvania area. And then, you know, a couple of them, Mid Carson July and Gray AM, kind of went on to sort of like some notoriety in that, that sort of late 90s proto emo scene, independent music scene. They toured a lot. And then a bunch of them, I think, ended up in Tampa, actually. But it was a, you know, for as small as it was a very vibrant and wonderful music scene.
What town, what was the closest city, just so people can put it into proximity here?
Harrisburg, an hour and a half south. State College, about an hour west. So, you know, State College had its own thing going as well. Yeah. Ethel, Missouri was really big there. Okay. And I think they're still widely regarded. Wilkes-Barre, Scranton was about an hour and a half northeast.
Okay.
So, you know, it was great. It was really good, but it was also sort of insulated as well. So a lot of the nonsense from like the Syracuse, you know, straight edge scene, you know, a bunch of us were straight edge, but like we were that older generation kind of insulated us from a lot of that sort of politics and nonsense and cult like stuff that was going on as well. Yeah.
Is that the difference between the East Coast and West Coast? Coast scenes, Kevin, because so we've been listening to a lot of people talk about the kind of DC scene and DC adjacent scenes. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of people on, and you and I grew up in the early 90s in the East Bay scene. Yeah. And they sound pretty similar. And I'm just wondering if like what differentiates the flavors there.
Well, I think Zach hit something really important, that like DC was incredibly prolific about documenting their music. So they had Ian driving Discord, which was putting out a record by almost every band, and all the people knew each other and like rotated bands and started new bands. And so there's that documentation. And I think the East Bay had that same thing with Lookout and Gilman Street. Right.
Right. Right.
So, you know, and they were a couple of years behind DC really effectively, but they took that model and ran with it in their own way. And I think it was a little more, you know, developed at that point, 'cause there was like touring and other stuff going on that was a little more developed, but, you know, all the smaller scenes around them, I think Gordon really played, you know, kind of commented well on this, is like, you kind of picked your scene to be influenced by if you were a smaller town. You know, it's like somebody got into something and everybody was like passing it around, you know? And,
exactly.
So, you know, I think it's interesting. I mean, you know, and like, I think smaller town breed a lot of creativity too, because people are so fucking bored. Like, you know,
well, that's it. Yeah.
You're hanging out together, right? Let's get shows. Let's do this. Let's, you know, and it was kind of the same conversation we were having with Zach yesterday. Like, you know, like he grew up in, you know, in what do you say? Rochester.
Yeah. North.
And so just another small scene, you know? And so I think like good people sort of congregate too. And if you've got good intentions and you've got inclusive intentions, that you're going to draw that in, you know, you know, definitely sounds like Gordon's scene was all about that. So as you got a little older, how did you branch out? 'Cause I know you're no longer in central Pennsylvania. So like, what was the impetus to leave, and kind of what happened with, you know, with you leaving town, and how was that?
Well, as good as the music scene was, like, I didn't want to be in a rural kind of, you know, red state area. So I wanted to go to Boston. I had a half brother there. I went to college at Brandeis outside of Boston, and basically like just did everything I could to be in a band.
Nice.
Like literally, like I was writing handwritten letters to bands in Boston that I'd seen.
Amazing.
Offering to like, you know, play cello for them or whatever. And eventually like one of them, Turkish Delight, broke up, but then they had gotten my letter. So two of the people formed another band and, you know, asked me to play in it.
Nice.
That was like freshman year of college. So I was playing in like a Gen X band with people 10 years older than me. starting my freshman year of college.
Amazing.
Taking the bus with my cello from college, you know, back and forth to rehearsals and stuff.
That's amazing.
It was absolutely absurd. And that gets to kind of another thing about, you know, when I was thinking of like adulting well and what that means in this day and age. And it's sort of like, be curious about your mental health and potential neurodiversity. I obviously had ADHD,
yeah,
and still do. And only now, like about the past year, I've been diagnosed with it and dealing with it. But I kind of wonder, like, if I had known then, would I have been doing those crazy things, like writing letters to bands?
right.
Maybe not.
Well, the treatment for it then would have been much different. So who knows what it would have done, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I think that's come a long way in terms of both, like, doing mind exercises and lowering the amounts of, like, incredibly powerful medications that they're giving.
Yes.
You know, teaching people to meditate is actually surprisingly helpful for ADHD, you know? So, you know, I think it's interesting. Who knows? I mean, you may have been writing more letters depending on what kind of, what chemical combination you'd been given at that time, right?
I found that, like, when I discover stuff like that about my own mental health, it's less that I would change my behavior, and it feels much more like a curtain opens up to explain myself.
Oh, that's better. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly how I thought about a year ago when I finally pursued.
Like, oh,
that. Yeah.
That's why and I'm an asshole.
Oh, okay. Now I get it. Now I understand.
Yeah.
Now it makes a lot more sense.
So what, do you mind? What was the band you were like taking the bus for to?
Oh yeah. It was a band called Betwixt. There's probably been like five other Betwixt since then, but it was the late '90s Boston band Betwixt. What's great is that we did two albums. It was sort of that, like, the last hurrah of the major label. Like, you knew what you were in for, but you could take the ride maybe for an album or two. And I think if we had stayed together past album number two, we would have probably had that chance for like an album or a third or fourth album. But we put out two albums, 97 to 99, 2000, somewhere around there, and really, actually, very proud of them. Very sort of like art rock, kind of experimental, female vocals. And we just got back together this a year ago to do two shows.
No way!
I got in super late the one night in Boston. We didn't make it over there, which was a bummer.
But yeah, it was sort of like, I remember the being very proud of those records, and the sort of litmus test was, all right, the first one I really like, and I would have copied it on cassette from somebody if I weren't in the band. Then the second one I would have bought.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And,
like, finally I made something I would have bought.
Yeah.
Right.
I knew that I was, you know, that was something to be proud of. And so that we reissued that record, the Salty Tang, on vinyl last year. And, that's why we did that reunion.
How was it playing together after all those years?
It was amazing. So, you know, I think that bands are, you know, have a particular magic in that it's an energy that can only be created by that combination of people and instruments.
Sure.
And it's sort of its own organism.
Right.
That manifests when, you know, I hate that word, but it manifests when those people are in the room. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like comes to life.
Right.
And so it, you know, it came back to life 20 years later.
It was familiar. It was that same kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really
cool.
We were
all different, and it felt different. Of course, it was a different time and space, and we were all different, but it was still that same sort of organism.
Nice.
That's
awesome. What were you studying in college at the time? You were doing both. You were like working the music and working for a degree.
So I ended up doing classical cello performance as the degree.
Amazing.
There's a good music program there and a history double major. But the classical actually really helped the rock. Mm-hmm. Weirdly.
I've heard that before, actually.
But, you know, it sort of like helped. And I think that, you know, when I picked up guitar at 15 as well, that my cello teacher at the time was like, oh, there it goes.
Oh, yeah.
But I was sitting there trying to figure out all the grunge songs by ear with my new guitar, and that helped my ear for cello.
Nice.
So those the two actually complemented each other.
Yeah, I mean, so just a quick side note, my daughter, my almost 14-year-old, plays harp.
Amazing.
And I went to pick her up at her mom's house a couple of years ago, before pre-pandemic. And I get there and I'm waiting kind of down. They had this, like, they were upstairs flat in a 2-unit building in San Francisco. And she yells down, "Daddy, come upstairs. I want to show you something." And lo and behold, she has learned Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven on harp. And where if I'm sitting in a music store and some kid starts doing that, I'm probably annoyed. But if I'm at my, you know, ex-wife's house and my then, you know, whatever 10-year-old daughter starts rocking that shit on harp, I was really excited. You know, I was like, raised right. So, you know, I think the rock crossover does help classical training. And it does. You know, it's like, and vice versa, right? If you're really into music, like, and really into listening, you can find amazing stuff. I mean, one of my bands used to steal from ABBA. So, you know, you just never know where that's going
to
come.
Well, I think people realize it now, and like, are open to it now. Like, you see all those Bach to rock schools, mm-hmm. where it's sort of, you know, it's both, both aspects. And that was not always the case. There was stigma in sort of both directions for generations.
Yeah. I mean, you finished college. The band obviously didn't continue after the second record. Like, kind of what, how did you transition into like, cause you've got the music you're doing now, which is, you know, way more than just the covers and transcribing other people's songs. I mean, you're working on some really intense stuff, with Zach from Jawbox and, you know, Jay's in that band as well. Sort of what happened between, cause that's, you know, now 20 years ago to now, that kind of got you to where you are now. What were you working on?
Well, funny enough, it actually was all the stuff 20 years ago that kind of set all that up. You know, in my high school bands, which were really fun, and Betwixt were both very, very heavily jam based and improvisational based, like kind of searching for the song, as a dialogue with the other musicians, as opposed to here's a song I wrote, let's all learn it.
Right.
And so that, you know, that really, you know, looking back, you know, that was a real blessing, because that kind of set me up to have that, the feeling of and comfort level to jam and to, you know, be really super creative. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of set me up to do something like Zach's new Freedom Sound, which is just a huge honor to be part of. And that's, I guess that's the thing I should be promoting, right? Because that came out like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Well,
on vinyl.
We did a lot of, like, I was pretty shameless in my praise of that record when we talked to Zach on the show. And, you know, I'm sort of one of those guys that can't help myself if I'm excited about something. That record is insane. I mean, I had the good fortune to hear some of these songs develop, because you'd sent me so much of what you all were working on, and they changed a lot, number one. And number two, they, like, the way that all of you play off each other is really, I mean, it's incredible. I know, like, you brought in the oboe player who's like that, he's a professional oboe player. The fact that you are such a wide mix of people and the backgrounds are pretty diverse, you know, it's just like, it's a really good record. I'm not going to go on and on about it a second day in a row, but and embarrass myself. But all I can say is, if you're curious, go to Bandcamp, listen to the songs. If you can afford it.
You know, Kevin, it's only 2 days in a row for us.
Yeah, that's true. Not for the show. Yeah. Not for our listeners, but it's insane. I mean, and I think one of the things that's really interesting, and you can talk about this for music nerds out there, is Zach brings sort of this, like, broad idea of what he wants, but he allows everybody that's collaborating to truly collaborate on the songs and bring, like, he doesn't tell you what to play on cello. He doesn't tell Jay what to play on piano. He's not in there saying, "Mark, you need to do this or that." It's like, all of it is very, like, like yeah. you bring your personalities and your playing to it. Talk about what it's like.
Does he bring the chord changes like and like a
not
song
so
structure?
Hmm. Not so much. It starts, the compositions for New Freedom Sound start out as drum compositions, which is fascinating in its own right. But it's drums looped with a vocal loop on top of it, and Zach is singing, which is something you would not potentially expect. You know, having fan of Zach broke his bands for the past 25
years. And then you play instruments over vocals and drums?
Exactly. Whoa! The way it works is Zach sends me that, like that sort of the nucleus of an idea. It's a drum, usually a drum loop and a vocal loop. And I'll sit there and, you know, find a spare moment and try to write some parts to it. And I try to usually do it in like layers, so it's not just a single cello, but like two or three or four. And then I listen back and realize that it's all shit, and I throw it all out and start over. And then usually that's when the magic starts to happen.
Sure.
So the second or third attempt is usually, you know, like, all right, now I feel where Zach's going with this. And then send those back. He puts a sort of skeleton of, you know, he cuts and pastes and copies and pastes and, you know, makes a kind of structure out of that. And then we take that into the studio.
But he must be singing to some scale or key or something that you have
he's just singing to the drum.
That's just amazing.
Yes. And it is, but I don't know how many people I think I've heard other people say this too, but I've always felt that Zach's parts are melodic.
Oh yeah.
Just in sort of like the way they flow and like the different, and it's so easy to hear, like even if he wasn't singing, it's so easy to like hear a melody.
Sure.
Kind of flowing out of the beat or the drum part. Yeah. And then, so even, you know, with him singing, it's even easier. And then, but you know, you still have to work on it. You know, a couple iterations probably. But I think part of the artistry of it is Zach's choice of players and how to instrumentation and how to bring them together. So yes, we do have total freedom to, you know, as long as we're like within the vibe and it is all about vibe. Like our unofficial motto is let the vibe decide. # let the vibe decide. But it really is about that. But part of the genius of it is the way Zach sequences and brings in people,
right,
to realize his vision.
Yeah, it's really very much should be on the playlist of any musician, in my opinion, because there's so much going on.
Thank
yeah,
you.
It's good. I mean, it's just good stuff. It's really, really intense and really not two pieces sound exactly the same, and that's also very hard to do. So when, during all this stuff, did you have time to get married and have a family? Cause you got a full life, man.
Well, again, ADHD, but no, it's been a great journey. You know, Kathy, my wife, and our two daughters, you know, we're very lucky. They're going into fourth and first grade now. Wow. But yeah, married in 2009, and Emma was born in 2013.
Nice.
So it's been a really fun ride.
Yeah.
Do the kids listen to the music? Do they listen to any?
They do. I try not to push it too much. I think, you know, I don't want to annoy them and turn them off from it. Right now they're super into BTS and like some other.
Oh wow.
We have a sort of pop playlist.
Hmm.
We just got back from a family trip and we just had to listen to it kind of over and over again. But, it could be worse.
Yeah,
at least they're into music.
Yeah, but
and BTS is pretty good. You know, I have to admit they've got it's a formula, but they're kind of masters of it, or whoever is writing the songs are masters of it.
Yeah,
I actually write all their songs.
Bravo!
So
excellent work.
I guess what's it like to play something like Fest as a cellist?
It's pretty awesome. I love Fest. I mean, again, it gets back to that whole community aspect that, you know, from way back in the Central Pennsylvania days. And in fact, you know, a lot of the people from that original Central Pennsylvania scene, like I said, some of them ended up in Florida or Tampa, that area. Mm-hmm. Their subsequent bands have been mainstays at Fest, or like they've helped helped organize it. And so whenever I go down to play it, they're there.
That's awesome.
At least like four or five, six of them. And we all kind of have a reunion, and it's a great time. Yeah. And it's just so cool to see people, you know, like-minded people from all across the country come together and kind of celebrate that punk scene.
Yeah.
You know, and not just punk, but, you know, ska and, you know, other lots of, I like how diverse it is as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're willing to have like classical renditions.
Well, that's the thing from like
live is,
you know,
cool.
I mean, most of the bands are pretty like, you know, upbeat. I mean, it's punk and ska and, you know, and hardcore. I mean, it's not like it's not like it's a like eclectic music festival really, but there you are playing cello. And so how do people react to your performances there?
Oh, I mean, it seems like everyone loves it, you know, and you know, what was really delightful last year, when I played, this other kid, the Ian, the punk cellist, mm-hmm. He goes by, it was his first Fest. And so he played in the Jawbreaker cello quartet for our set. Mm-hmm. And he also did his own solo set of punk cello karaoke stuff. And people ate it up. Like they absolutely loved it. And so now he's like really, he's making videos and he's like doing punk karaoke shows and like wedding, you know, elder emo weddings and stuff like that, where people walk down to like favorite, walk down the aisle of their favorite emo songs or what have you.
It's amazing.
It's awesome. It's great. Like he doesn't have family and kids, at least at this point. So it's cool to see him like, you know, kind of, you know, really, really go all in on it. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But it was great. It was great to meet him and like the other two cellists we played with, Melissa, who's from Tampa, who has played in a lot of Florida bands.
Nice.
And has her own kind of rock orchestra in Tampa called Same Day Delivery Orchestra.
Nice.
And, you know, and she recruited the fourth cellist last year, and it's awesome. It's a great time.
That's amazing. What was I going to ask? So, how did you start doing these covers? Like, where did that like come into play? Because, you know, you're doing stuff with like, you know, all these amazing other musicians, and then, you know, bam, here's this like, you know, these like punk covers that you're doing.
Well, I have Apocalyptica to thank, the Finnish cello quartet, who kind of as a joke did a Metallica album in like 98, 99, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a hit, and like it, you know, I think it was the first time, you know, there, of course, there've been string versions of rock music, you know, for as long as there's been rock music, but it was the first time you could really hear like Metallica done like in that sort of classical way. And I think later they played with the San Francisco Orchestra and stuff. Wow. But that was such a great collection of arrangements. And I was assigned some sort of independent project that I had to come up with for my music degree.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, what can I do that's sort of like this Apocalyptica, but totally weird and offbeat, but is also heavy and melodic. Mm-hmm. I was like, Jawbox, it's perfect.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They're heavy, they're powerful, and like there's just this beautiful melodic stuff going on, you know, all throughout every song.
Yeah.
And so I did a bunch of Jawbox arrangements, recording them on my 4-track, and I think I got an A for the project, but
nice. Congratulations.
It didn't sound very good at the time, but I did send copies of it off to Jawbox and they were kind of like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
But they remembered me like later when I moved to DC. And so that was how I kind of got
nice.
Got in with the DC music scene at that point.
So did you,
and I think by that point, actually, people were doing lots of benefits for Cal Robbins.
Yeah.
Who, sadly has passed away last year, but you know, benefits for Jay and Janet, of course, but you know, for Cal's diagnosis of spinal muscular atrophy. And so I redid the Jawbox arrangements, you know, in an actual studio, not just on my four track. And that's kind of how it started.
Yeah, that's a tough story. I remember the benefits going on, and you know, it's not something that that any parent should have to go through. You know, honestly, it's a tough one. But you know, I think the community really rallied around them in a really
again another great example of like community music,
yep.
Community via music. Yep. And how powerful it can be.
Yeah. So, I mean, did you get, didn't you do a Dark Side of the Moon on cello?
I did.
And was there any problem with Roger Waters or Pink Floyd with that? Or did you just do it? Or did you have to pay?
At the time you could, I don't know if you still can, but at the time you could get, you know, the mechanical licenses via Harry Fox Agency, okay. I think. And so that's what I did. Okay. I got enough for like the 300 records I made and some amount of digital downloads. And it was cool. Funny. I think at the time I was explaining that to Brian at Discord or somebody at Discord, and they're like, oh, that's what that Harry Fox Agency thing is that keeps sending us money that I have no idea what. Yes, because people are actually trying to be trying to be ethical and like pay Discord for the rights to, you know, cover. Yeah, they're bands.
That's funny. I never even thought about that. Like, what bands must get money from them? You know, like just randomly.
Well, probably it's a small percentage that actually like bother to license it. But I of course I had a Kickstarter for that, and I wanted to do it all sort of above board.
Well, you also don't want to mess with Pink Floyd, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Roger Waters isn't exactly known for being like super easy. You know, and I'm not sure what the arrangement is around that record, but, you know, I'm sure he's got some residuals involved in that in some way, because he definitely performs it. You know, I've seen him play live, and he, to be honest, I'm a Pink Floyd fan, so I'm not even going to like try to hide that. I love that band. Seen him play a number of times, and it's always been quite an experience. So, you know, he brings the show.
I never got the chance.
Yeah. I brought a friend of mine to see, The Wall when they were here in San Francisco doing that when Roger, and that was when him and Gilmore were getting along. So Gilmore would have here and there show up and play at the shows.
Wow. That's incredible.
So, you know, I was like hoping for that night, but no dice. But yeah, that's a really cool record too. And I like, how do you pick this stuff? Is it just stuff you love and you think it's going to go well on cello?
That's basically it.
You're just like,
right now I'm working on Chavez.
Oh, really?
Which has probably an audience of about like 30 people, yeah. but it's going really well in terms of like, it sounds good.
Yeah.
And it suits cello well, partly because they detuned their guitar so much,
right.
And to some of the same open strings that the cello is tuned.
That makes sense.
Oh, wow. Cool.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So when you did the Jawbreaker on cello, I mean, I know the reaction was Jawbreaker fans are like a special breed. It seems, you know, I follow the boards and stuff still, and it seems like it was met with like a lot of love and support. Like, how did that whole thing?
It seems that way. And I was not expecting,
yeah.
You know, I thought it would get like a small potentially positive reception from, you know, a small group of people who would be open to that version of it, and, you know, and expected like a lot of people to be like, what the hell, you know, classical, but no, like everyone who heard it seemed to like it, which I was really, really honored that,
it's so good. I wouldn't be surprised if it's a bridge the other direction too for people from classical music into Jawbreaker.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, probably. But again, I think it, like with Jawbox, it goes to the strength of the songs and the melodies because they're so compelling. You know, it's mm-hmm. and they're so beautiful too. And you know, when you think of punk, like the beautiful is not necessarily the first sort of like descriptor that comes to mind, I think, for most people, right. But there's so many bands that it actually is, you know, and it, all it takes is just like hearing it in a slightly different instrumentation to be like, oh, wow.
Yeah. You know,
that's an amazing melody.
Yeah. How have the live shows been going with Jay and like during COVID? How are you feeling about all that?
The most recent set of shows we did was amazing. Yeah. And that was in May. That was a set of acoustic shows just with Jay, so guitar, cello, voice, and opening for Bob Mole, who was doing electric solo. Yeah. And that was sort of throughout the, you know, places scattered throughout the Northeast. Right. And that was an incredible experience. I mean, obviously opening for Bob Mole is really incredible, no matter what sort of configuration it is or how many shows you do.
Yeah, he's pretty okay. He's like, he's all right.
Yeah. I will say though that I did the Betwixt shows, I did Fest and like a couple other shows, like one show with Jay and a couple other things in the fall of 2021. Mm-hmm. And I didn't necessarily expect to be kind of like on the bleeding edge of you know, the resurgence of live music post COVID. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty stressful.
Yeah.
And sure. maybe if, you know, if I had the choice again, I wouldn't have done it, but it was a lot. It was, you know, a lot to do and a lot of stress and honestly, like, amazing, but so stressful that like, it was hard to enjoy it. It was hard to relax and just enjoy what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, I don't know. I had tickets to a lot of stuff at that point and canceled a lot of it. And then we did those live shows for the podcast and it was pretty, it was a little scary. You know, I was a little like, ooh, am I doing the right thing? Like, and the funny thing is I didn't even get COVID until a few months ago after all this.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And really? So many people have heard the same.
And it was like I think my wife and I got it on Father's Day. Like,
I think
we got it. Like, we had one of the guys, one of my buddies from work and his kids over, but we were outside the whole time, but it spreads so quickly now and it's just such a different virus. I was just, you know, but it knocked me out for sure. I'm still very cautious. So we usually go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say Kathy and the kids actually got COVID like in the last couple of days of the Bob Mold tour.
Oh, really?
Which you know, up to that point, the tour had been amazing, but that was super stressful to like finish out the last couple of shows and then drive back to, you know, a beleaguered household.
The COVID house. Yeah, it's tough. So usually we wrap around 45 minutes. Hard to believe it's been 45 minutes. It feels like it's been about 10 minutes. you know, just like it's such a great conversation. And it's really nice to have you on here and just hear a little bit more about, you know, what you've been doing and your process. And, you know, I'm so like unapologetic about my fanhood for people that I really respect. So, you know, and I think that we were talking about this yesterday, like it really plays into like, there's more love for music when I know the person is like a deeply good person, you know, like it just, you know, just really, it like, for some reason, no, I feel like I can hear it at that point once I know them, you know, but, you know, what do you got coming up next? Like you told us what you're working on cello wise, but what else is happening? Are you guys, is New Freedom Sound going to do any live shows, or is that just going to be a recording thing?
I mean, it would be amazing to do a New Freedom live show. I don't know how that would work. I think you'd need at least two drummers, probably not, and then, you know, a percussionist beyond that, five vocalists, three cellists, like 10, you know, clone Mark Cisneros 10 times, you know, I don't know, but, it's not out of the realm of possibility. We have talked about it and sort of like I said, wouldn't it be cool if, but we are going to record again in January, I think, which is amazing.
Nice.
Jay and I are playing the acoustic show September 10th, the Metro Gallery in Baltimore. And then the band, Jay Robbins Band, is going to open for Girls Against Boys at the Black Hat in DC on October 15th.
Amazing.
Which is another dream come true.
Oh my God. Wow. I didn't even know they were playing shows right now. That's
incredible. Yeah. I mean, they'd done a little bit of reunion in that EP before COVID and now they're back at it, I think.
That's going to be amazing.
That is.
What's the date on that?
Saturday, October 15th.
Okay. I gotta
see you there.
I gotta figure out if I can get to DC in October. Gotta find a reason to be on the East Coast. I'm sure Suave and I can work on something on the other show. You know.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm here. I don't think I've ever been to that club either.
Well, it's only half of what it, of the Black Cat. It's the bigger,
okay,
bigger half. They had to sell off or I don't know, or their lease ran out on the Red Room, okay, which was the bar in the back, right, backstage, smaller venue.
Yeah,
which was I love playing there because it was more intimate. Yeah. Although the main stage is amazing too.
Well, that sounds like an amazing show. So we'll, you know, watch out for that if you're in the.
Hey, DC. Wait a minute! There are more freedoms than tracks here. On the,
yes, you noticed.
Wait
that.
A minute. Okay, all right. I'm gonna have to investigate this.
So yes, so there are, you know, there are freedoms that got cut.
Oh,
sound record, or that didn't make the cut. I should say, for full band.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, but I agree with the choices that were made.
It's enough freedoms.
It's enough. Yeah.
Okay.
Freedom isn't free.
It is not. So, well, thank you, Gordon, for coming on and just, you know. Thank super you. Awesome to have you. We've been looking forward to this for like a month, so you know.
It's my pleasure. Seriously, I've been looking forward to this a lot, and yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it was nice to meet you, and thanks for listening, everybody.